Wireless on Flirt FM 101.3.
Hello and welcome to Wireless, a programme all about radio broadcast on Flirt FM 101.3 in Galway and on flirtfm.ie. And as ever, a very special welcome to all of our listeners on other community radio stations across Ireland. I'm John Walsh and I'll be with you for the next hour. Wireless covers all aspects of radio, analogue and digital broadcasting, community, regional and national broadcasters, niche broadcasting, pirate radio, podcasting, radio ownership and radio's history and future prospects. Coming up on the November edition of Wireless. To mark the annual community radio Féile organised by CRAIL, we hear from broadcast academic Rosemary Day about the state of the sector in Ireland. As 8 Radio returns to FM around the country, founder Simon Marr gives us the background to the station. And we take an inside look at the backbone of commercial local radio, the mid-morning talk show with former Clare FM presenter Gavin Grace.
Wireless on Flirt FM 101.3. Follow us on Twitter at Wireless Flirt.
The annual CRAIL Féile, or Festival of Community Radio, was again hosted by Community Radio Kilkenny City this year and provided a valuable opportunity for practitioners and watchers of radio to meet up physically after a completely online event in 2020. Last year, one of those addressing the CRAIL Féile was Dr. Rosemary Day of Mary Immaculate College from the University of Limerick, who took stock of the state of community radio in Ireland at the moment. Here she is, as heard in the December 2020 edition of Wireless.
As Declan said at the very beginning, this is hugely important because the last time we did something like this, it became the definition for community radio and then for community media that the BAI, or the regulator, used to regulate, to give out licences, to help and support the sector. And in some cases, as the way of saying that they couldn't do things with us because it wasn't in the definition. And I'm kind of anxious to say today a few things that I want us to become, and I'm like the national school teacher. I went to school before these were invented, but I have a few cards here. I was going to use PowerPoint slides, but I said this might belt it into your brains. We need to talk about how we're aware of what we're doing. And I think that when I was asked to do this talk or whatever, Mary Lennon asked me because she knew I had just written a chapter which was looking back at the past of community radio and at how the community radio movement grew in Ireland and how we shared, how we came to together generate and share a vision. And so I was just going to give that. And then as I was preparing for this, I said, no, sure, that'll be written down in print. What we need to do is think about what lessons can we learn from that 40 years of working collectively and shaping a vision and trying to have an influence on policy? How can we use that going forward? So Sean's phrase there of having a continuum, and I think Pat Stanton said it's like stretching it, whatever phrase we use for it, we need to continue the work that we're doing. Communication is the way that we work to help communities make the world a better place for individuals and for themselves to improve life. So what we need to do is to maybe give ourselves a pat on the back, because where we are now in 2020 with CRAIL and with, you know, the strength of stations is really strong, despite, and I heard what Eilish was saying about having worries over money and over insurance. But really, even though those are very true, It's important to realise that community radio as a movement has strengthened and has grown. But how did that happen? And I would suggest that there are four, and this is really now, I wanted to remember these, so I used words for them that all began with A. So the first thing we need to do is to be aware of what we stand for and aware of how we came together to do these things. And then we need to be able to articulate them. So we need to do just what Sean is doing for us now. We need to be able to write down very clearly what it is we stand for, what it is we're about. And in order to be able to do that, then that's what leads us to being active, to be able to act and to actually get results. But the thing that we need to do that we've been maybe remiss in doing over the last 40 years is to advertise ourselves. And so if we're advertising ourselves, not just to funders and to politicians, where we've become reasonably good at doing that, and we have a good relationship with the regulator, but how do we go to advertise what we do in the general population? And I'm not going to start on a negative note, so I'm going to come back to that at the end. But the advertising raises awareness as well, not just awareness of those important people who give us funding, of those important people who license us, of those important people who say we can make changes in legislation that say that recognize what we're about. But very much the most important people with whom we engage, which is the people in our communities, right to the level of the volunteers in our stations, because this isn't news. We've often said it. How often do we have people in our stations who think that what they're there to do is to be a DJ or to, you know, use it, and it's okay as a stepping stone to a career in another station? We know we're far more valuable than that, and we need to raise the awareness constantly with each new person coming in. So when Mary gave me the opportunity to share what I had learned over the summer in looking back at how we shaped our vision, I said to myself, you know, there are many people here today who couldn't have been around for the last 40 years. And so to give you a really quick dateline, not of all the wonderful things that were done in stations, I think the social benefit toolkit that Sean introduced to us last year, we didn't introduce because he worked with it for all of us to get it, is fantastic for that. But just to look at some of maybe the high level milestones for us as a movement. So looking back over time, back in the very wild days of piracy, and I see Brian Green is sitting up there up front, but there's quite a few radio pirates sitting here today. There were a number of people who were using radio not just to spin discs, but also they saw it much as a way of connecting people, of getting people to communicate with each other. And they were doing so in separate stations. There was Yall, there was Connemara, there was the Forerunner of Near, there was Concord, and they didn't know each other. So gradually over time, some really strong activists, and I won't name names, but some of them are still around, they began to get together, and they decided that, you know, there's always strength, like the trade union movement, there's always strength when you come together. And so they formed an association they called the National Association for Community Broadcasting, the NACB. And that lobbied, and, you know, it had an input into the shaping of legislation. Over the 80s, there were so many changes in governments, and there were so many times the bill, an act for broadcasting was promised and it didn't happen. I'm not going to go into that, but what's really interesting is that the NACB wrote a charter, and Jack Byrne was instrumental in writing that charter. And the NACB was founded in 1983, the same year that AMARC was founded. And what's interesting, and this is something that I really want to come back to about being active and in raising our awareness, here we go, is that AMARC and the NACB began to talk to each other. And much of what the Irish had put into the charter for what community radio should do transferred over to the AMARC Europe Charter. And since then, for the last 23 years or more, the AMARC Europe Charter, which people think came in from outside, but actually came from Ireland and came back a bit like Irish music, it's been influencing how we work and how we do things. But what's crucial is that while the NACB splintered and different people went to commercial and other people stayed with community, what remained was what they wrote down. So to be able to articulate your vision is hugely important. And the articulation of that vision led very much to the strength in lobbying for licenses. In 1993, we get Radio na Laoghaire, and we get the forerunner of Dublin City FM, we get Anna Livia coming on air. And the following year, the regulatory authority, the IRTC, had, you know, the famous pilot scheme for 11 stations. Even with all of the work and all of the articulation and the raising of awareness, the regulatory authority wasn't convinced that community radio was a good thing. And I don't want to be, you know, looking for shadows and fears around every corner, but I do have a certain sense of unease that we could, and I'll come back to this maybe at the end or maybe in the open discussion, we need to be careful that we continue to articulate what it is that we stand for as community media people, so that others, well, others can make what they want, but that those who are focused on content only don't end up, if there are spoils to be taken, if there is core funding to come or whatever, that they don't end up taking it. I think it's useful to look at the foundation of TG Cahir, which is a different animal, but so many independent production houses were set up. And in the early years, it was said that they could use crew who could only, who couldn't speak Irish, because obviously we needed to upskill, etc. But now, how many years later, 25 going on for 30 years later, there are still many, many production houses who get that funding, who haven't, who've upskilled their people, but they haven't introduced Irish speakers into the mix or learned to speak Irish. So I'm not switching from one of my hobby horses to another, or one of my passions, I should say, but there is a lesson to be learned there. When money comes into the equation and we need it, we need to be careful that we ring fence it for the people who are going to benefit from it. Okay, so I've gone off on a tangent there. So back to the 1990s. One of the biggest and most important things that happened, that came out of that pilot scheme, is not just the continued existence of those nine stations and the addition of another 11 or 12 since, but it's the working together, the formation of the Community Radio Forum, which became CRAIL today. And thanks are due to Kieran Cassan, particularly there, because as a very young man, he was tasked with monitoring the work of the stations, but he took that remit and moved it so much further. So people who were initially quite suspicious of each other and who were overworked and overexhausted were enticed, forced, cajoled to come and meet each other twice a year. And from that, a working group was put together, which came up with the definition that we've used for the last 23 years. So that's why Sean's work at the moment is so important. If for the last 23 years, when we individual stations have changed so much, if that has been the abiding definition by which we are, if you like, governed, certainly monitored, definitely licensed and supported through, then it's essential for us that we feed in, give Sean all of the feedback that he needs now to give us a policy document, which the BEI will decide anyway. We're only being consulted. It's not our document this time. It wasn't the last time either, but it became so. That we need to really be active. I'll leave my cards down. We really need to be active in doing that so that while we will change hugely over the next 23 years, this policy will probably last for 10 years at least, if not for longer. Whether the BAI is still here or not, whatever iteration, whatever commission we have, this is a crucial moment for us going forward. So we need to put the time into it now. So that was probably the two biggest things that came out of the 1990s, was the formation of CRAIL, which supports and sustains every individual station and makes us stronger together. And CRAIL's second job, if you like, or function, is to lobby and to represent us, to be active on our behalf and to articulate our needs, but also our vision. And CRAIL has been incredible in doing that over the last 20 years on absolutely tiny funds. In 2009, as a result of some of the activists in, I don't know if it was called CRAIL then, but succeeded in getting the Minister for Communications at the time, Eamon Ryan, to insert that crucial two words, that phrase, social benefit, into legislation. And that changed everything, because it was a recognition for the first time of how we were a different animal, how we differ from RTE and from Live 95 in Limerick, or from Clare FM, or from FM 104 or whoever. It put it down clearly on paper. And it was also the first time that we got a real definition in legislation. And up to that point, there was no distinction made in legislation between us and your local commercial radio station. I keep talking about radio, but I'm talking about the past, and we need to move it forward to all the different ways we can do media. And then last year in 2019, Sean came to the FELA with the toolkit, which he didn't make up out of his own head. He brought together what everybody was saying, what they were doing. And it's a fantastic document to have to show to funders and to prove to, if journalists ever bother to ask, what we're doing. But what we need to do now with what's going forward to the BAI is to really input there and make sure that, as Sean says, the policy document will only be about 3 pages, I think Sean said, to make sure that that is flexible enough and resilient, drawing from the theme of today's conference, resilient enough and flexible enough for us to be able to change and move, because we're very close to the ground and we'll react to what we need to do. And we're, I was at the technological workshop and it's amazing what people are doing and how innovative they are. So we're all of those things, but a definition that's articulated, it stays. So we need to be careful that we get that right. Out of the social benefit toolkit, one really good thing came, which was that the BAI recognised that CRAIL were really, this is what we're about, and that we wanted funding for it. Unfortunately, though, it coincided with COVID and with, and here I think it's important that we look at our role in this. The government announced that there would be a huge amount of funding, I think 750,000 for community radio. For emergency funding. So I know from talking to people in CRAIL and in stations that many stations were ready to go to the wall. They were absolutely put to the pin of their collar. And the scheme, quite sensibly, was divided into two parts, the larger part going for emergency funding for commercial stations and the smaller part going to community radio stations. But where the problem I see is, and this is why we need to be very careful in our articulation of what we're about, and in our activity as activists, as people who are putting, we need to be more assertive. Because instead of being like the county councils that gave small to medium-sized enterprises cash within weeks, and instead of being like the commercial stations who got cash within weeks, Michael O'Keefe announced this morning that the BAI will meet on the 30th of November, and then the funds will flow after that. And why is that? I think it's a misguided good intention. And I think the CRAIL needs to be more assertive in stepping in sooner when this kind of thing happens and to not be afraid of being assertive. We serve the people. We have a right to broadcast and we have a right, therefore, to that money. And that money, I think, which was emergency cash, shouldn't have been tied to any conditions like social benefit. It's almost, and I don't think this was the intention, but it's almost as though there's a lack of trust in what stations are going to do with it. Nobody was going to run off to the Bahamas because they couldn't get a flight. I wouldn't be able to put up with the quarantine or whatever. Nobody was going to run away with the cash, but we all, stations needed it and they still need it. And I think we need to stand together collectively when we're being assertive. We stand within and behind CRAIL in this. There was a distinction made, and I cannot understand why, between community of interest stations and community geographic communities. So geographic community stations can apply for up to 40,000, and a community of interest like student stations or like Radio na Lifa could only apply for up to 30,000. Yet they all do social benefit. They're all community radio stations. We have those distinctions. I won't go into the reasons why. There's lots of good reasons. But when it comes down to the need for money, when it comes down to the need for the DOSH to support ourselves and not go to the wall, they're the same. So I think that's another lesson that, well, does happen to begin with. A, we need to have no flashcard. We need to be assertive. And we need to not be afraid of the regulator. I'm speaking as somebody who has just come off the board, and I don't know whether anybody will be going back on it or how it's going to work. It's all up in the air. But whatever comes after the BAI, like we've had three already. We've had the IRTC, we've had the BCI, now we've had the BAI. Something else will come there. Let's hope it's as good and as supportive and as friendly as the executive and the boards of the regulator have been up to now. But whatever comes, we have come of age. We in CRAIL now exist and we're a strong voice for people. We have a mandate and we're not getting things as presents. OK, it's not that aren't we so lucky to have it. These are things that we're entitled to. So I think that we need to come back to that idea of articulating our vision really strongly and being active in promoting it and pushing towards it. So the things that I've hoped that I've got you thinking about are about us after we do all the work in our individual stations, to think about us as a collective, us as a movement. And while we have been good at being aware ourselves and what we're doing, and while we've been good at working collectively, organising, we got into legislation in 2009. We've tried since and we'll keep trying. We've had a definition in 1997. We're going to have another one now, a new policy coming up probably next year in 2021. While we've been good at all of those things, the thing that we have been, they've all come, as I said, from being articulate about what we're about, being not just united, but being able to spell it out and put it into a document or a charter that we can all adhere to. But what we've really been poor about, okay, so this is the depressing bit, is I'm looking for my cards, is this one about advertising. And I don't even like the word because it smacks of for money, etc. But it began with A, so I threw it in there. We need to spread the message. And we have been very poor at doing that over the last 40 years. And if we're to learn anything as we change from being just radio to being part of the hubs that Sean was talking about and stretching ourselves, as Pat said, if we're to go anywhere, we need to, okay, continue to do what we've done with legislators, with regulators, continue to work collectively and continue to look for funding, etc. But what we really need to do and concentrate some of our energy now on is telling other people what we do. So if you think about it, how many of your friends and relations, even after you spending 30 years in your station or 3 months, still think that what you're doing is going into play or that it's your hobby? Or that they're asking you, they'd say, ah, sure, Rosie, sure, she couldn't make it she never got the job in RT, but she's doing it there on her look, ah, the creator. That's not what we're doing. And it's our fault if other people don't know. We've tried different things. We tried publishing books. We've had, I think DCTV did a very good television documentary series. We're much better on social media than we realize. We need maybe one or two people who'll be committed to this and who'll be paid for it. Again, that dreaded word of money. But we definitely can't keep putting it on the long finger. So over the last 40 years, and I'll stop now, we've always had the problems that Eilish brought up in the last session of not being able to pay for the insurance or not being able to pay the electricity bill. And that's never going to go away. Even if we get new funding, even if we get AVMDS funding and we get a new pubble or whatever, we're never going to have enough money. And I'm not belittling the point. That's a fact. We are never going to have enough for the dreams and the vision that we have, because we can keep working and keep doing more. But unless we take some time and put some effort into telling other people why what we do is so important, we're not going to grow. Back in 2000, we had 20 community radio stations. We only have 21 or 22 now. There's no good reason, and I know I sat on the BAI, but I still can't come up with a good reason, really, why all those aspirant stations still have to struggle and continue with 100 days. It doesn't have to be, Sean called it a micro station, and I think we all like the idea, but we need to step back a bit and say, but surely isn't that what we do anyway? Isn't that what we are? Isn't that what we started by being? And before things got expensive or before things got so high, we were able to do that. So, you know, we need to ask ourselves, why haven't we grown more? And I think those four A's, if I can use them again here, I put them together in one: to be more aware, to be active, to articulate that awareness and spread it and to advertise means that we will raise more awareness. That's all I have to say for now. Thanks.
Dr. Rosemary Day, head of the Department of Media and Communications at Mary Immaculate College, the University of Limerick, addressing the 2020 Craol Féile in Kilkenny about the state of community radio in Ireland today.
Wireless on Flirt FM 101.3. Follow us on Twitter at Wireless Flirt.
We're delighted to hear the indie music station 8radio.com back on FM in Dublin, Cork, Limerick and Galway to celebrate its 8th birthday. Normally 8 Radio is online only but has been heard on several temporary licences over the years and indeed is a very welcome addition to the bland Irish airwaves. In October 2017, I met the station's founder, Simon Marr, and asked him about his pirate radio past and how 8 Radio came into being.
The first shows that I would have done on radio at all, probably like countless others, would have been on Radio Dublin in the very early 1990s, maybe 1991 or so. And then at that stage, there was a whole batch of sort of fairly small-scale pirate stations that had started up, you know, and I ended up working on one that was in Sandyford for a while, and then on one that started then from my house, which is Coast FM in, I think, 1992, there or thereabouts, was in the bedroom and eventually the back garden of my ma's house in Ballybrack.
Okay, and how long did Coast last for then?
I think Coast was around for 4 or 5 years. I think it went up until sort of early, maybe even mid to 1996, you know, and I was there. And I think eventually it was at the point where both the radio station and myself probably were less than welcome, probably is a bad way of saying it. But it was time for everybody to move on.
In terms of your family?
Yeah, that's fine, but also in radio terms, because it was like there were things that we wanted to do, but they weren't really feasible to be done in the back garden of a, you know, a house. So it was like, okay, well, what do we want to do? So look, there was a few of us that sort of come together who had an interest in the rockier side of things, whether they be sort of on the radio side or on the music performance side, of being in bands or DJing in clubs or whatever it was. And we came up with the idea, why don't we do a thing that plays rock music? And that's where Spectrum was created. And at that point, that kind of almost naturally brought Coast FM to a close.
And Spectrum then became Phantom, of course, but where was Spectrum itself based?
Spectrum was based in a shed in Sandyford, and the old shed that Sunset Radio used to buzz in the big dance days of the early 1990s, and we were looking for somewhere to put the station. This place became available and we went, ideal. Absolutely ideal, let's do this. We went and we rented the shed and the equipment and all this, the technical bits that were available with it. And we were there from, I think Spectrum started late 1996, and we were there until 1999. So we were there for two and a half years anyway.
And was that when Phantom was born then, in 99?
Yeah, well, no, Phantom was born in probably 98. There was a few aboard of it. Spectrum kind of lumbered on for a while, and then it sort of, once again, almost naturally, not any huge event happened, but almost kind of naturally fell apart. And then when we were putting Phantom together, Phantom was a much more organised version of what Spectrum was. Spectrum was just about, you know, let's play some Led Zeppelin records, whereas Phantom was, well, why don't we put together a radio station? It was much more in that sense. So it sort of ran probably the whole of 98 and then into 99. And at that point, it was in 1999 that we had the opportunity came up to potentially apply for a licence and actually put a radio station together that could be something a bit more than just a shed in Sandyford.
And how did you decide that this was actually a viable proposition for a licence?
I think partly it was we had started to get a response. You know, we got a phone line in, which is a big deal, into the shed. Got a phone line in, and the phone started ringing, and it was people we didn't know. And we thought, my goodness, what's going on here? And then it never stopped ringing. And then we started to get a lot of interest from local bands. And, you know, bands that would have been sort of big enough at the time. You know, the likes of the Frames and the Mary Janes and Brando and all those sort of bands at the time, you know, who were quite big but just weren't getting airplay elsewhere. And we kind of thought, okay, there is something to this. You know, we thought, okay, well, this is something that's possibly worth our while pursuing as something more than just somewhere that was a deadly place to go and a great place to have fun in.
And I know you made a few attempts, I think you made a few licence applications before you were successful.
We did, it took us three attempts before we were successful. First in 1999, let's face it, we really were learning, and it came down to a choice between us and I think a Dublin relay of Radio France International. And they didn't give the licence to anybody at that time. The second time around in 2001, by that stage we were based in Wexford Street, upstairs in Whelan's, not too far away from where we are now. And the station that day had grown quite a lot. And we put together, I think, the best of our three applications was the second application.
In 2001.
And that was the application, that was the licence that subsequently went to Star Broadcasting, as it was then, which became Dublin's Country, which eventually has become Sunshine. And then the third time we applied then was in 2004. And that's when we put together a very heavyweight consortium. And that came down then to a choice between us and ZFM. So which would have been Bob Geldof and Niall Stokes and various other people at that stage. And that's the one that we eventually won out on.
And just to backtrack for a moment to the 2001 application then, why was it so good, do you think?
It was so the model that we had put together for that one made an awful lot of sense. you know, as an
looking,
with the benefit of hindsight. Oh, absolutely. Okay, jeez, yeah. With the benefit of hindsight, you know, it was looking at sort of revenues of about £500,000. It was looking at a fairly small staff. It was looking at modest audience targets, all those sort of things, you know, and a huge focus on the output of the station. You know, by the time we got to 2004, it was like, okay, we have one more shot at this. You know, what is it that we need to do? And what we needed to do was persuade the BCI or the BAI, you know, that this thing is going to work. How do we do that? Well, we've got to go in big because everybody else is going to go in big. And we've got to go in with heavy hitters, you know, a big heavy hitter names. And that's what we did.
So you had very significant business backing then.
Oh, absolutely. When you think in 2004, we had the likes of Paul McGuinness, you know, and Trevor Bone, who were managing U2 at the time. We had Dennis Desmond from MCD and Gate Investments and all that stuff. We had Paul Kavanagh, who had recently been the CEO of News Talk, but also had run Atlantic 252 and was then in running Riviera. We had Frank Gleeson, who's the owner of Whelan's and the Village, as it was at the time. We had the Malloys. Brian Malloy had been chairman of Radio Ireland, you know, and his son Graeme as well. They were all involved in Westland Recording Studios and the records. So it was a big, you know, it was a very big and a very powerful consortium, probably put together out of elements of previous consortium that other people had put together. Mm-hmm. You know, and even at that point, we had turned away an awful lot of people, you know, who wanted to become involved.
And that's the one that the BAI opted for.
That's the one the BAI opted for, and it was very, very strong. But and it was big in money terms as well. You know, we were talking about putting in a couple of million quid to get the thing off the ground. You know, having, you know, like a sort of a decent war chest of £1 million available then to pay the bills. You know, so it had to be, everything about it had to be big. And once again, in hindsight, it was far too much, far too much.
Mm-hmm. And tell us then about the early days of Phantom as a legal station then. What exactly was going on and what was the product like? I mean, I remember listening myself, but
yeah,
give us a flavour from your side.
The product initially, I suppose it took us a while for it to settle because we were trying to be all sorts of things. We were trying to be this mass appeal, but almost like an oxymoron. We were trying to be a mass appeal alternative music station, you know, and it doesn't necessarily work that way. And it took us probably 6 months anyway to work out that, okay, no, we need to be able to focus this down this little bit more. And we did it. And we did it very well. You know, we had 18, 19 full-time staff. In the first year, we probably brought in £800,000. You know, the second year, we brought in just over £1 million, you know. So there's a lot of money coming in. But the fact that in order for us to get to the point of break even, we needed to be bringing in £1.5 million a year just for the station to break even. So it's an awful lot of money. So while we were doing well, and in fairness, this was sort of 2006, 2007, 2008, there was a lot of money sloshing around. We were in no way prepared for what happened then in 2008.
And that, of course, was the crash.
Exactly.
And the crash seriously dented the rise of Phantom.
And absolutely, we hadn't reached the point, because we'd been delayed by the legal challenge from ZFM for the best part of 2 years getting on the air, we hadn't got ourselves to that break-even point yet. So by the time the crash came around, we were probably 70% of the way to break-even. So we probably were looking at bringing in 1.3 million maybe in 2008. And in that last quarter of 2008, revenue dropped off by 30-40%. 2009 was even worse, you know, and suddenly now there's a hole of £500,000 or £600,000 in your, you know, revenue versus expenditure, and then you know that there's big trouble.
And were other stations not facing similar pressures, or were you particularly badly hit?
I think we were just particularly badly hit because of the timing. You know, other stations, yeah, they got hit massively, you know, but you know, you had stations, you know, any station that was losing 30-40% of its revenue, you know, is going to feel it and felt it badly, whether you're, you know, 98FM or Today FM, but they were established.
Yeah.
So they got to that point, you know, they even had, you know, they'd accumulated profits, all of that stuff. We hadn't reached that level. So there was always going to be pressure once we got to the stage where, okay, income and expenditure aren't balancing out, what do we need to do to fix this up? And I've always said this, where we made the mistake at the time, was the mistake that we made was we messed with the output too much rather than making radical changes to the model, which is what needed to be done.
So what did that mean in practical terms?
That meant in practical terms is that we changed the music, we tried to appeal to a casual audience, you know, we tried to do everything that we could to boost audience rather than cutting back our cost base radically, which was really the only thing that could have been done.
And I know then that you departed company from Phantom.
Yeah.
Shortly after that. When roughly did that happen?
That happened. We sort of went on through 2009. 2010 then, we had got to probably mid-2010, and we knew that we needed to bring in some new investment, you know, because even of the investors who were involved in the station, some of them were starting to struggle when it came to the cash calls, you know, so the big guys were swallowing up a lot of the shareholding at that stage. We said, look, we've got to do something in order to try and arrest this decline. So there was significant debate at the time then about what we should do, you know, and how we should bring in investment. And at one stage then, an investment proposal was presented by the chairman, pretty much as a fait accompli, that Communicorp would come in, would buy one third of the station and would operate it and would bring it, you know, make it successful and make it worth $5 million in 2 years and all the usual stuff. There was some disagreement as to whether that was the route to take. I believed that it was the, I obviously still believe that it was the wrong route to take, but at the time, that's what happened, you know. Communicorp came in. I was relieved of my duties, shall we say, and they made the changes that they saw fit. Now, and when I say that, is that it was natural that when Communicorp came in, that they would want to have their say, have their own people in charge, you know, be doing what it is that they saw fit, the things that they thought were the right things to do. To me, they look like mad, daft things to do. It's probably hindsight again, as shown that they probably were a bit daft, but they were their things to do, so they did that. And part of that was that I would go, and that they would do things like they, you know, chop the music library down to 300, bring in many more comedy elements, those sort of things, like, you know, to try and boost the station.
And you felt that was too mainstream, was it?
I felt that the station had a choice of going one of two ways. It could go and become something a bit more chin strokey and sort of super serve a smaller audience, but based around a new business model, or it could decide it was going to be an alternative pop station, I suppose, you know, and go down that route. But I thought that the worst thing you could possibly do is have a compromise, a hodgepodge in between, you know, where you've got like a comedian or a reality TV star on, you know, playing this bizarre mix of 300 songs. You know, I thought that's never going to work. And I'd been watching it with particular interest, watching the fortunes of stations like XFM in London and Kerrang and various stations that had tried that whole thing, you know, and I'd seen what had happened to it and kind of went, oh no, this isn't going to end well.
And do you think, is that what the end of Phantom and TXFM?
I think that's pretty much it, is that even when the TXFM launch came about, and obviously I was long gone at that stage, is there was an opportunity at that stage to be a thing, to very much be a thing. We are the, you know, chin-stroking alternative rock station. You know, we are the Six Music of Ireland, or we are the, you know, the indie pop or the, you know, station of Ireland aimed at, you know, a much younger audience, maybe a 15 to 24-year-old audience. But it inevitably ended up going back into that sort of compromise where it sat in the middle. And where you sit in the middle, with anything, particularly in the radio business, if you're not a specific thing, the people, it's not that they stop liking you, it's that they stop caring. And once people stop caring, that was it was doomed.
This is Rock and Roll Radio.
You ready? Okay, mate, let's do it.
Hi, this is Joe from Hot Chip.
Hi, we're Tudor Cinema Club.
Hi, this is Kim Deal calling from Dayton, Ohio.
If I want to find out what's going on in music, I always turn on Phantom.
Thank you very much, Ed.
This is the bass player from Razorlight.
This is Liam, the Cortinas.
And the keyboard player from the Kaiser Chiefs, right?
And you're listening to Phantom 105.2.
And you're listening to Phantom 102.5, is that right? Brilliant.
Phantom 105.2. Good times.
Oh, yes, indeed, it's fun times.
Simon Marr, founder of 8radio.com and lecturer in radio in Ballyfermot College of Further Education in Dublin, speaking to me on the October 2017 edition of Wireless.
Wireless on Flirt FM 101.3. Follow us on Twitter at Wireless Flirt.
And finally, the mid-morning talk and current affairs show is the backbone of Irish commercial radio, with local stations throughout the country, especially outside Dublin, ploughing big resources into this part of the broadcasting day. On Clare FM, the show is called Morning Focus and is now presented by Alan Morrissey. For over a decade until the spring of this year, it was presented by Gavin Grace. In the November 2020 edition of Wireless, I went behind the scenes of Morning Focus with Gavin.
Morning Focus, or a variation thereof, it was formerly called On a Clare Day. It's been at the heart of the Clare FM schedule since the station launched in September 1989, obviously well before my time. But as you'll be aware, John, when local radio started, these talk shows became, these mid-morning talk shows became the vehicle of choice to drive listenership, to discuss local issues and to set local radio apart. And I still think it's doing that to this day. In terms of my own involvement, I joined Clare FM in January of 2010, but that was as a news journalist. I subsequently worked as deputy news editor, and I've been hosting the programme since August of 2015. So just over 5 years I've been a full-time host now.
And you are a news editor of Clare FM as well, isn't that right?
That's right, yes. So it's a very busy day, busy morning when you're planning your news output for the day, assessing events that have happened overnight and how they'll impact both your news bulletins and indeed the show itself.
So we'll come back maybe to the news angle later on and your role there, but sure. To come back to Morning Focus then, what are the programme's aims and how does it tie in with the kind of requirements that local radio has in terms of speech content?
It's a really good question, and I don't know if I've got a distinct answer for it. I suppose there are a lot of aims in any programme, but to me, and it's a very obvious one, it's my intention that Morning Focus serves the people of Clare as best as is possible. And that involves discussing the issues that matter to the listeners at home. I also, to be frank, want the show to sound like the sort of show that I would listen to. I took over from John Cook, who was the previous host, a fabulous host who had been in the chair for about 11 years, I think, when he left. He's gone on to Radio 1 now. And I decided very early on that while I wouldn't throw the baby out with the bathwater, that I would gradually shift the programme towards something that I was a little bit more comfortable with, interested in, and as a presenter, something that I could put my style on and my footprint on. We've done more sport, for example. It's something that I would be quite fond of. At the same time, I'm very conscious that there's an audience there that has been built up over, well, for now over 30 years, that I want to serve, and I would have a very strong ethos in, as much as we can, highlighting community events and positive community initiatives, reaching out as best we can, even in these strained times, reaching out to towns and villages all over Clare, telling people what's happening on their doorstep. And then all of those aims and ambitions, and a few more, including, you know, I've got a drive to try and hear some really interesting personal stories from people, and that's always been a big feature of the show. But all of that then gets mixed in together, and we aim for that every day. We don't always get to it all, but that's certainly the aim over the course of each morning.
So does this contribute significantly then to the requirement to have 20% news and current affairs between 7 a.m. and 7 p.m.? Obviously, it's a big contributing factor to that. Would that be correct?
Yeah, absolutely, indeed. Now, some of that is a bit above my pay grade. We do a comprehensive local news service as well as the show. And my understanding, and don't quote me on figures in this, John, my understanding is that we would be well in excess of the 20%. I would also argue, though, it's not just for regulations. I think that if that regulation was thrown out tomorrow morning, certainly in Clare FM and probably in every other local radio station, you would see the mid-morning talk show continue, because it's a big driver for listenership as well, you know. And to my mind, and I'm biased because I'm not a music presenter, but to my mind, the local content, the local speech content will always be, in news and sport, will always be the driver of audiences for local radio, because it's something that we can offer that is distinct and unique, and you won't get it anywhere else.
And how do you put it together then? There's a lot of different aspects to it, a lot of different segments, different styles, different themes and so on. So what's the template, or is there a template for how you balance the various elements?
There's a template at the end of the day. And I'll start there and then work forward. So when I left this evening, I had a fair idea, and I have a fair idea of what we will do on air tomorrow morning. But of course, from now until then, things could change. So I suppose the first part of the template is to react to and to reflect the breaking news stories that matter. And we didn't experience that today. I can get into it in a short while. You have your regular features. We traditionally try to do sport on a Monday. We have a regular vet slot, a regular GP slot. We have legal advice. Our dog warden is a popular local character, and he's had a slot in that programme forever and a day. And then you try then to, I suppose, there isn't necessarily a template to the show, but you try then and give people what they're expecting. And for us, that has moulded into our hardest news items coming towards the top of the programme, and then our softest, lighter community events perhaps coming towards the end, but with little bumps along the way. You don't want it to be doom and gloom at the start of a show. But there's no one template. There's no... Things change, and people's availability comes into it as well. You know, if you can only get a minister for the second last slot in the programme, well, then that's when you'll do it. So, I don't know what a template be the right word with respect. There's a model, there's a framework, but it can change every day.
And is geography an issue, Gavin? Do you feel a need to cover all parts of the county, or is it just driven by the news agenda?
Primarily, we're driven by the news agenda, but geography is, of course, an issue. And it's our obligation, in my eyes, to ensure that when we're covering what's happening in County Clare, that we reflect what's happening in all of County Clare. Now, I'm fortunate, unlike some other local stations, that we have one county to focus on. But each town has its own identity. In some ways, different parts of Clare would have almost have different... Maybe not cultures, but certainly different approaches to life. West Clare is Gaelic football country. Maiden and East Clare is hurling country. And there's only a small number of places where the two should meet in the main. But that's just an example. Sport, of course, isn't the only thing. But you do try to reach out. You do try to get to every area. And I said, look, it's a moral obligation. But, you know, from a business point of view, if you're going to get a... Whenever they come back, if you're going to get a JNLR survey and they land in a particular community and they ask the people there what they're listening to, then if you've been talking about them and if you've been speaking with people from that community, they're more likely to remember you than not. So there's an element of that to it as well. But that's not the driving factor, but it would be a very big mistake to ignore an area, I feel.
And would you have contacts all over the counties? Would you have people who would provide you with leads on stories or, you know, angles that you could cover? Or would you be going after people?
It's a bit of both, you know. But yes, you would have people in most parts of Clare that if something is happening, I can pick up the phone and ring them and get a steer at the very least. But I mean, I'm blessed by the fact that I came into a station that was... whatever, 20 years old or thereabouts. So, you know, those contacts, a lot of them were there before I came. I've cultivated a few, of course. You continue to work on that as and when you can. But, I mean, that's the role of any journalist.
You mentioned a news story that broke today, and I should say that we were recording this interview on the day that Ryanair announced that it was pulling out of Shannon and Cork for the winter. And I have to say that when I heard that on your programme this morning, I said, aha, it's going to be a very busy day for Gavin. How did that pan out in the end, and how did you cover it?
Okay, so it didn't come as a surprise, firstly. It's a temporary closure of their bases this winter. But Ryanair have been flagging this for a couple of weeks. Nonetheless, it's obviously very significant. Shannon Airport is the economic heartbeat of Clare, the Midwest, and beyond as well. So instantly when this came, you know it's going to be a big story. The first I heard of it was, although again it didn't come as a surprise, the first confirmation I heard of it was at approximately probably 7:25 this morning. And from then on, you have a producer, Rebecca, who's brilliant at what she does. And Fiona Cahill was working in our news at the time. So I'm liaising with them both in terms of how we will cover it in our different ways. So Fiona writes a news story and I edit it before it's recorded and put to air. I speak with Rebecca then about the guests we're going to get on. And you just start ringing people, effectively. Got onto Ryanair. They wouldn't talk. The airport themselves issued a statement later that they haven't done an interview yet. I expect that to come tomorrow. But you're, I suppose, in an instant like that where you've got a breaking story, you're trying to get reaction. And then, of course, I mentioned a while ago, in the evening, I have an idea of what's coming tomorrow. You have to ring up a couple of people and say, I'm very sorry, but we're not going to get to your item today. And that's the nature of it. People, by and large, are understanding. There's an expectation from the audience that you'll cover all of these events, that you'll do so well. And unfortunately, you have to throw out the bathwater every now and then to do so. But that's just a process you're very used to. Sometimes it happens during the programme. Another story that broke about 24 hours ago as we record this, of course, John, was the COVID restrictions were increased. So we had the ban on visits to homes, the level 4 restrictions as well in Donegal, Cavan and Monaghan. And while that's not necessarily the most relevant to Clare, it so happened that in a post-budget interview, I had Minister Heather Humphreys from County Monaghan on the programme this morning. So much as I'd love to say that one was, again, reacting to the story, sometimes you get a little bit lucky as well.
So in the 10 years that you've taken over the programme, Gavin, social media has powered ahead and is now a very serious challenge to traditional media. So how do you navigate that environment on a morning programme like your own?
It's a minefield, and I could write an essay about it because there's so many different ways in which it impacts what we do, and some of it's very obvious. You have to get your message out there, you have to be faster, you have to make sure that you are where people are so you're on social media, but it makes it very hard to switch off from the job, if I'm honest, and it's one of the biggest drawbacks of it. I think, look, at from a media point of view, I haven't gotten too wrapped up in the challenge aspect of it, because I'm not gonna change anything by worrying about it too much. I think we just have to embrace it and go with it. We have a system where stories posted to our website are automatically tweeted. We have a system where we schedule stories to go up on Facebook. We promote the program on social media. We've just had to adapt and change, and if I'm honest, add to our work model, our workflow and our workload just to keep up with it, basically.
And of course, another huge challenge in the last 7-8 months has been COVID-19. Yeah. So presumably a lot of your work is now done remotely, or how often do you broadcast from Ennis these days?
I'm actually back in the studio. I'm more comfortable in the studio, to be honest with you. And for now, I think I can still continue that and safely. I mean, I have to give credit to Clare FM. We've put in a really comprehensive plan to ensure that all of us are safe. There's no issue with social distancing. We've installed a screen in the studio that's in between myself and my guests. And I know other stations haven't done that. They undergo temperature checks as well. We all do when we go into the building. So from that point of view, I feel safe in the studio. I did, and I'll continue to do some shows from home. And that never happened before COVID. And there's aspects of it I enjoy. The commute is much shorter to go from upstairs to downstairs. But I think you need to work with, I think in my job, you need to be able to work closely with a team. And when we had to be out of the office for that period in April in particular, it was frustrating. Aspects of it were certainly frustrating. So I was glad to get back there and look at, if COVID drives me out of it, we're prepared to go and do it again. But fingers crossed, I'll cross my fingers and hope against hope that doesn't come anytime soon.
And does Morning Focus drive the news agenda then itself a bit for Clare FM? Because you are head of news as well, and obviously there's a major news bulletin at lunchtime and again at 5 p.m. So to what extent does Morning Focus contribute to the news output of the station?
To a big extent, but that's important for any station, I think. I mean, your current affairs programme is your flagship show, so if you're bringing on your news makers, then what they say on your airwaves have to be news. So one feeds the other. You know, sometimes there's a very good news story that becomes the spark of a discussion item on the show. The two have to work hand in hand. I haven't got extensive experience working in another radio station's newsroom, but to me, it's certainly the best model, but not just in terms of workflow, because it obviously helps, you know, that you get two bites of a cherry out of an interview, shall we say. But if I can bring on a senior politician, for example, and talk to them about the news of the day, then their answers are news. So, yeah, it feeds it to a big extent, but the news is its own distinct identity and does its own work as well. It's a mix between both.
Gavin Grace, formerly of Clare FM, speaking to me in November last year about the daily talk and current affairs programme Morning Focus. And that brings us to the end of this edition of Wireless on Flirt FM. Join us again in December for another show featuring the best from our archives over the last 5 years. But in the meantime, you can follow us on Twitter at Wireless Flirt and also on facebook.com/wirelessflirt. You can also listen to previous shows on our website, where you can subscribe to our podcast. We're available on Spotify, Stitcher, iTunes, Castbox, Player.fm, Podcast Addict and Acast. Until the December edition of Wireless, this is John Walsh wishing you good listening.
Wireless on Flirt FM 101.3.